The Jews answered Jesus, "Aren't we right in saying that you are a Samaritan and demon-possessed?" "I am not possessed by a demon," said Jesus, "but I honour my Father, and you dishonour me. I am not seeking glory for myself, but there is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. I tell you the truth, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." At this the Jews exclaimed, "Now we know that you are demon-possessed. Abraham died, and so did the prophets. Yet you say that if anyone keeps your word, he will never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham? He died, and so did the prophets. Who do you think you are?" Jesus replied, "If I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. Though you do not know him, I know him. If I said I did not, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him and keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day. He saw it and was glad." "You are not yet 50 years old, the Jews said to him, "and you have seen Abraham?" "I tell you the truth," Jesus answered, "before Abraham was born, I am." At this, they picked up stones to stone him, but Jesus hid himself, slipping away from the temple grounds.
Well, do keep that open, page 1074. The issue we're looking at this evening has all to do with confirmation of identity, and therefore with authority and ability. I guess it's something all of us are used to. We're regularly being asked to confirm our identity. If you're one of these people who fly overseas regularly midweek, you have to produce your passport. All of us have to sign checks or credit bills or receipts. Many of us use passwords on a regular basis to access data. But the issue of identity and authority and ability that is being confirmed this evening isn't simply our identity. So this passage has to do with our identity. It is about our identity and confirming our identity, but it's not just our identity that's being discussed in the reading that we just had. Part of the issue is the identity, the authority, and the ability of Jesus. And we can see that from verse 48, just as the Jews start, "Aren't we right in saying that you're a Samaritan and demon-possessed?" And so Jesus goes on, "I'm not." Verse 53. Verse 52, "Now we know that you're demon-possessed," etc. "Are you greater than our father Abraham?" Verse 53. Verse 57, "You're not yet 50 years old," the Jews said, "and you have seen Abraham." So part of the issue this evening is the identity of Jesus Christ, his authority, his ability, and confirmation of his identity. But because Jesus makes claims both about himself and about us, and because he claims to speak authoritatively about us and about our identity, as we see his identity confirmed, so we'll begin to see our identity confirmed. So there are two identities that are being discussed, ours and Jesus's, and Jesus as the authority, if he is held up as the authority, tells us about our identity. The issue then is one of identity and confirmation of identity, and the question is both Jesus's and our identity. Now that kind of line of argument is something that we're quite used to. Take the issue of genetically modified food, for example, which has not a great deal to do with our identity, but you may be aware that there's a battle raging about the research of a certain professor whose name completely escapes me. I don't think I'd be able to pronounce it anyway, if I could remember it, that he's conducted over these last few years, and if his research can be shown to be inauthentic and flawed, then the scare about GM food is only a scare. But if he is held up as authentic, and his diagnosis and his research is held up as authentic and can be confirmed, then everything he says is confirmed. So a whole lot hangs on his credentials and his methods. But when we're looking at the teaching of Jesus Christ, there's a lot more that hangs on his credentials. Because Jesus' assumption about us and about our identity and about our ability, as we've been hearing already, is that we are spiritually helpless on our own, and that he alone can help us. So he assumes that we are what he calls slaves to sin, that we are not naturally a part of God's family, that we are by nature in and of ourselves unable to respond to God positively. He assumes, and we'll see that as we look at last week's teaching, that without God breaking in to effect a change in us and in his people, we are powerless to help ourselves spiritually. You see, that's something that makes the sort of genetic food scare pale into insignificance. The tabloids ought to be shouting about this claim of Jesus that in and of ourselves we're not members of God's family. Quite the opposite, in fact, that in and of ourselves we can't help ourselves spiritually, that we are slaves to sin. That's the point of verse 31, isn't it? Just have a look at verse 31. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples. Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." Now, a person who needs to be set free is a captive. And a captive, by definition, is powerless to help themselves if they're so captured that they need somebody to break in and set them free. Let's just remember, as a recap from last week, who it is that Jesus is talking to, because these people Jesus is talking to do have a fine religious pedigree. It's really important we remember that as we look at chapter 8. Their religious pedigree is immaculate. They can trace their ancestry all the way back to Abraham himself. Now, there may be one or two people here today that can do that, but very few. Even Jesus assumes that they are physically related to Abraham. Have a look at verse 37. "I know you are Abraham's descendants." They have a religious pedigree. Their religious performance is impressive. So here they are at one of these key feasts of the Jews. And verse 59, if you just have a look there at the end of the reading we had today, they are in the temple. So they've traveled to fulfill their religious obligation. So they have a religious pedigree. Their religious performance is obviously impressive. And what is more, and this is the really striking thing, they, of all the people in Jerusalem, are the select few who have responded positively to Jesus. Did you notice that in verse 31? To the Jews who had believed him. So they've got a pedigree, they've got all the performance, and it appears that they have responded positively to Jesus. But Jesus insists that appearances can be deceptive, and that for all their religious effort and all their background, they still need a work from him to break in and effect a change in them if they're going to become part of God's family. They can't do it on their own bat, on themselves. And that's the point of verse 34 through to 36. I tell you the truth. It's one of three I tell you the truths in chapter 8 from verse 31. I tell you the truth. Everyone who sins is a slave to sin. A slave has no permanent place in the family, but the Son belongs to it forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. In other words, they're enslaved. We are enslaved. Captive, unable to do anything about it ourselves unless somebody breaks in and effects a change. Now, this teaching that we are spiritually helpless and that we need the help of Jesus runs counter to the general mood of the age we live in, just as it did to the age in which Jesus lived. You only have to spend a couple of minutes glancing at any one of the numerous books on self-help spirituality in any one of our bookstalls to realize that the assumption that we are actually helpless and can do nothing in and of ourselves but need somebody to break in from outside, that assumption runs counter to the whole mood of the age. Now, our age assumes that just as we can do it yourself at the week on our houses, so we can perfectly do a bit of DIY when it comes to a relationship with God. But do you see, Jesus is flatly contradicting that. He assumes that without him we are spiritually helpless, that without him in and of ourselves we can't do anything by way of responding to God positively. He assumes that if we're given a kind of spiritual map and compass and told to get out on a great quest for God, that however impressive and sincere the kind of religious construct that we develop, our quest will always fail. He assumes that we're not good enough to be part of God's family. We're slaves to slaves to sin. Quite the opposite. And by the time we get to verse 47, he who belongs to God hears what God says. The reason you do not hear is that you do not belong to God. So for all their kind of religious appearance, their pedigree, their performance, their positive response, in and of themselves, they are slaves to sin and unable to do anything about it. Now that was really where we got to last week. We may be deeply sincere in our religious beliefs, but if we think we can do it ourselves without Jesus, we are deeply and sincerely deluded. We may have a religious pedigree coming from the finest family of Christian believers that stretches back down through the centuries. We may be in the mosque at every hour of prayer. We may have been to our first Mass and attended every Mass and Saints' Day since. We may come from a long line of Protestants. But Jesus assumes that without him we are slaves to sin, that there's no way we can break free. Anyone who sins is a slave to sin. And therefore that all of us shall face death and separation from God. And verse 43 and 44 state the case very starkly. Why is my language not clear to you, you religious, highly qualified, impressive group? Why is my language not clear to you? Because you're unable to hear what I say. You belong to your father the devil and you want to carry out his desire. Now those are pretty bold claims, aren't they? That's where we got to last week, and I just wanted to recap because they are very bold claims about our identity. And we're quite right, I think, to say, well, where's the proof? How can we know that this is true? And that's why from verse 48, the issue shifts slightly from our identity to Jesus' identity. So that's the question in verse 48. Aren't we right in saying that you're a Samaritan and demon-possessed? That is the issue in verse 52. Now we know that you're demon-possessed. And that again is the issue in verse 57. You're not 50 years old, and you say you've seen Abraham. So the issue shifts, you see, now to prove Jesus' identity, to show that he really is the authority on the matter of our spiritual identity. First, he announces his arrival as God's son. Secondly, he shows us that Abraham anticipates his arrival as God's son. Finally, he shows us that God authenticates his arrival as God's son. First, let's be clear that he is announcing his arrival as God's son. And we can see that in verse 34. So if you look back, I put it in first, even though it comes last in this week's passage, because it was there in verse 34, 35, and 36. I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. Now a slave has no permanent place in the family, but the Son, that's what it says literally, the Son belongs to it forever. So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. But just to make sure that we don't miss the point, at the end of the reading, did you notice that Jesus announces his arrival as God's Son again? So in verse 57, you're not yet 50 years old and you've seen Abraham. Jesus then says the third of the I tell you the truth. I tell you the truth. Before Abraham was born, I am. At this, they picked up stones to stone him. Now, there should be no doubting that Jesus considered himself to be divine and announces himself as such. We've explained this point a number of times from here over the last few weeks. But that name, I am, is the name that God uses for himself. It's altogether appropriate if you think about it. If you or I were to call ourselves I am, well, it would be rather absurd because after all, you may be for 40, 50, 60, 70 years maybe a little bit longer. You may be, but after that, you no longer are. You're a has-been, so as to speak. You know, when you die, you're not. And before you were born, you weren't. Mortal men and women would never give themselves the name, the eternal I am, who goes on being I am, present tense I am existing all the way down through the ages. Because we don't exist forever in the way that God does. But God, who exists forever outside of time, is before the beginning of creation. He is after the end of time. Go back 2,000 years and he is. Push the fast forward button forward another 1,000 years and he is. He exists forever. And so the name I am is entirely appropriate for God. But you see in verse 57 to 59, I tell you the truth, the third emphatic statement of truth. I tell you the truth, before Abraham was, I am. And there's no doubt in his listener's mind as to who he is announcing that he is. What do? They pick up stones to stone him. I was taught for a brief while at theological college by a man who didn't think that Jesus thought he was God. Now, it does seem to me to beg a belief when you have a statement like this linked in with the name of God in the Old Testament, and supported by the fact that the people who listened to Jesus recognized that he was claiming himself to be God. It seems to be quite extraordinary that a person could say that Jesus didn't think he was God. Just turn over to chapter 10, verse 30. Do you see it? I and the Father are one. So first, Jesus announces his arrival as God's Son. I want to be clear on that. It's there in the passage. He is announcing his arrival as God's Son, breaking in from outside to effect a change. Second, Abraham anticipates Jesus' arrival as God's Son. And that's the point of the discussion running from verse 52 to 56, which is summed up in verse 56. So we're back on 1,074:5, verse 56. Your father Abraham rejoiced at the thought of seeing my day, he saw it and was glad. Now, that is staggering, isn't it? Not only did Abraham, way back, look forward to Jesus' coming, he saw it. And that can only mean that even 2,000 years before the birth of Jesus, God had already announced his arrival, the arrival of Jesus Christ. He had planned it. He had purposed the sending of his Son to break into his creation, to effect a change in people such that they could turn to him. He planned it, 2,000 years before the beginning of creation. But certainly he announces it to Abraham. You see, this truth that we are slaves to sin, that we're unable to do anything about it, has been around long before Jesus Christ actually came in history. So when Adam and Eve rebel against God at the instigation of the serpent, what happens? They're thrown out of the garden, they're cut off from the tree of life and from God. And it becomes clear that they need rescue if they're to be reunited with God. Now turn back to Genesis chapter 12. Genesis 12 verse 2 on page 13, right at the beginning. Genesis 12, 2. God speaking to Abraham, I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you. I will make your name great and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I will curse. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Over to chapter 22 and verse 15. Page 22, verse 16. I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you've done this, you haven't withheld your son, your only son. I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you've obeyed me. Now those two promises, promised to Abraham thousands of years before the birth of Jesus, speak of a people being blessed through Abraham, through his offspring, through his descendants. And here back in chapter 8, Jesus is saying to these Jews who will not listen to his word, listen, Abraham looked forward to the arrival of God's Son. Abraham looked forward to my arrival. He saw my arrival and he rejoiced. And if you're taking notes, chapter 12, verse 41, Isaiah saw the coming of Jesus Christ too, according to Jesus. So, do you see, these Old Testament writers, these great men of faith, the ones to whom Jesus would listen, Jesus' listeners would have appealed, they anticipated the arrival of God's Son. Jesus announces his arrival, Abraham anticipated his arrival. The whole purpose and plan of God through the centuries has been pointing to the arrival of God's Son to break in and deal with our slavery to sin. So much so that the heroes of the faith looked forward to it. I don't know if you've come across the art fraud John Drew. Did you read about him a few weeks ago? A detective sergeant investigating the case said that his fraud was the biggest contemporary art fraud of the 20th century. Brilliantly carried out. The damage done is considerable. Well, his sort of work spanned 10 years, and the discovery of it rocked the art world. But the way he operated was to gain access back into the archives of various institutions to alter the historical documentation so that it looked then as if the fake painting that he was presenting to the dealers had been around for years. So when he came to sell his work, well, the archival evidence pointed to the existence of his painting, and he was able to pull the wool over the dealer's eyes. Now, Jesus' point is this. The whole tapestry of the Old Testament, stretching back thousands of years, points forward and anticipates the arrival of God's Son breaking into his creation to set us free from slavery to sin. There's no way that Jesus could possibly have altered that archival evidence, if you like. Unlike John Drew, who was able to break into one or two archives to alter the one or two bits of evidence, this evidence had been around for thousands of years. Everybody knew it. It was part of the whole culture of the Jewish nation. There was no way that there could have been a wide-scale tampering with the promises to God's people over thousands of years. And so Jesus says, in this issue of confirmation of my identity, Jesus announces it, Abraham anticipated it. You should have been waiting for it. But thirdly, God authenticates it. And this is the key point that comes in verse 49 and 50. Just have a look down at them. I am not possessed by a demon, said Jesus. I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. I am not seeking glory for myself, but there is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. Picked up again in verse 54, if I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My Father, whom you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. Now here's the point, you see. Jesus doesn't seek glory for himself. He isn't into self-promotion. His claims aren't something that he's just made up on his own. And all the way through his life and ministry, Jesus obeys God. God glorifies him by working in and through him. The Father authenticates the work of Jesus. That is the point in chapter 7, just back a page, chapter 7, verse 31. Many in the crowd put their faith in him. They said, when the Christ comes, will he do more miraculous signs than these? Turn over to chapter 9, verse 30. The man born blind in verse 30, who Jesus heals, in argument with the Jews. This is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Turn over to chapter 11. You can see the blind man. He recognizes that God glorifies the Son by authenticating his work. Turn over to chapter 11, verse 40. Did I not tell you, this is at Lazarus's tomb, did I not tell you that if you believed you would see the glory of God? So they took the stone away. Then Jesus looked up and said, Father, I thank you that you've heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this for the benefit of the people standing here, that they may believe that you sent me. When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The dead man came out, his hands and feet wrapped with strips of linen and a cloth around his face. So God authenticates his Son, you see, by the resurrection of Jesus, by the giving of sight to the blind. God authenticates his Son by his Son's own resurrection. God authenticates his Son by glorifying his Son at the death and resurrection of his Son, which John doesn't explain here in chapter 8, but he goes on to explain in the rest of the Gospel. All the way through the Gospel of John, God is working to authenticate the ministry of Jesus, to show that he really has arrived as God's Son, that he therefore has authority to speak. Just a few weeks ago, I had one of those rare and memorable sessions at the dentist. I want to put on record right now that I have an excellent dentist. He lectures at Guy's Hospital. His surgery is in Borough High Street. And if you know him, please pass on my very finest regards. He's a fine bloke, and rarely have I come across such an excellent practitioner of the art. But that's just in case I have to go to him again in the next week or two. But he was once the world land speed record holder, and in his patient waiting room, he has on the wall pictures, medals, photographs, certificates to prove it. I know there are a number of trainee dentists with us this evening, and I think if I may, I'd like to give some patient feedback. Don't bother putting up medals of your various personal achievements on display in your waiting room, because we are totally disinterested in what you have done outside of the field of dentistry. As we lie powerless in your chair and you start crashing around in our mouths with a crowbar, the fact that you drive your car faster than anybody else in the world is of absolutely no concern to me at all. You may be the world number one mountain gorilla wrestler, for all I'm concerned. What I want to know is that you are authenticated through your training, through your exams, through the certificates, and those are the things you should stick up on your wall. Because once I see that you have been authenticated, that you really are who you say you are, that you really have authority as a trained and able individual, then I am happy to accept your diagnosis and your solution. Now, Jesus announces his arrival as God's Son. Abraham looks forward, the whole of the Old Testament looks forward to God's Son breaking in. God the Father and Judge authenticates the arrival of God's Son. And if you doubt it, if you doubt the identity of God's Son, well, let me ask you for a second to see if you can explain why Jesus was able to do the kind of things he was able to do. How did he heal the man born blind if he wasn't from God? How did he call Lazarus out of the tomb when he'd been dead for 4 days? Why did he go to the cross? How did he rise from the dead? Where did the power come from? You see, if you were to have to stand up here this evening to give a talk on the life of Jesus, what would you say? You could say that the stories were made up, but you'd have tremendous difficulty doing that because the eyewitnesses who give us this evidence are not the kind of people who make up stories. They believe in truth. They die for truth. Their whole writing is about factual, historical truth. You can't say that they're ignorant peasants because who make up legends and myths, because this writing is heralded to be some of the finest writing that our world has ever seen. Ignorant peasants can't write that sort of thing. You see, the only reasonable answer is that the power comes from God. And that means that his diagnosis of our identity must be right. He announces his arrival as God's Son. Abraham looks forward to his arrival. The whole of the Old Testament anticipates his arrival. God authenticates his arrival. And if he is God's Son, if he is divine, if he has been eternally, if he has been forever, if he is God, then he knows. He has authority on us and on our condition, which means that you and I are slaves to sin. we are powerless to help ourselves spiritually. We are unable in and of ourselves to respond to God. Now, last week we looked at Article 10 and of the Church of England. We also looked at the Westminster Confession of Faith, which we haven't got time for this week, for those of you who like that. Article 10 of the 39 Articles of the Church of England says this. We personalized it, so I'm going to personalize it again this week. I am very far gone from original righteousness, and of my own nature I am inclined to evil, so that my flesh lusts always contrary to the Spirit, and I deserve God's wrath. My condition after the fall of Adam is such that I cannot turn and prepare myself by my own natural strength, by my own good works, to faith and to calling upon God. I have no power to do good works, pleasant and acceptable to God, without the grace of God. Now that sums up, that is based on, that sums up Jesus' teaching that we are slaves to sin. And I want to address, as we close, two groups of people, if I may. First, the person who might be here this evening who would not yet call themselves a Christian. It's great that you're here, if you are here as somebody in that category. And I want you to take a moment, for a moment, and to think about a Christian friend of yours. Okay, maybe they're sitting next to you. Maybe it's just somebody you know who's a Christian. It's terribly easy, isn't it, to think that your Christian friend is here this evening singing these songs that we sing, doing the kind of things that we do, listening to Jesus and believing in him, because there is some inherent quality in that person, this friend of yours, that enables them to do it. It's very easy, isn't it, to think that this friend of yours has some kind of religious gene that means that they are into Christianity. So, some people have sports genes, not many of us in England. Most of them have gone off to Australia now. I don't know how we managed to do it, but it's happened. Australia and South Africa have all the sports genes now. Some people have the sports genes. Others have the culture gene. We won't go on about that. Some have the scientific gene. Some have the scientific gene. Or others, I don't know, have the gene of intelligence. Others have the religious gene. And your friend just happens to be one of those. They have a kind of religious thing about them. Might be that it comes out in maybe one of the other religions, but maybe it comes out in Christianity. But you see, Jesus' teaching flatly contradicts that, doesn't it? And his teaching is backed up by his authority and his identity. He says that there is nothing within any of us here this evening that enables us to respond positively to God. Nothing we can boast about. No religious pedigree. No religious performance, not even our own positive response to Jesus is down to us, because we are slaves to sin, powerless, unable. It requires God to break in and effect a change. Then, if I may I address Christians amongst us. Again, it's great that Christians are here this evening. It's a wonderful thing. I want you to think for a moment about perhaps the person who wouldn't yet call themselves a Christian. Maybe a friend of yours. Maybe a member of our family. And this friend of ours may rather balk at this teaching that in and of ourselves there is nothing about us that enables us to be part of God's family. No way that we can respond because we're slaves to sin. This friend of ours may be affected by the culture of our age, and they say to themselves, well, surely I can do it myself. Surely I can buy into some great world religion and just work away at it. Surely I can develop my own kind of religion, a bit of a hodgepodge of this, that and the other, and then God will accept me as I work away at it. Well, I want to hold up for us Christians the evidence of chapter 8 taught by Jesus, to show us that these friends of ours, however impressive they may look, are not naturally part of God's family. First, their own sinful nature cries out, well, our own sinful nature cries out against us. Verse 34, anyone who sins is a slave to sin. However hard we try, we can't stop sinning, rebelling against God. We're unable to do it. Our own sinful nature cries out against us. The world we look in cries out, we look at as we look out on the world cries out against us. That however much money we plough into the world, we are unable to stop rebelling against God. Second, all of Jesus' teaching stands out against us if we refuse to accept his verdict that we are slaves to sin and helpless, and if we think we can somehow get to God on our own. Verse 34, I tell you the truth. Everyone who sins is a slave to sin. A slave has no permanent place in the family. All of Jesus' teaching stands out against you if you think you can get to God on your own. Thirdly, the whole of the Old Testament stands out against you if you think that there is some way that you can work your way into God's presence on your own. If you refuse to accept Jesus' verdict that we are spiritually helpless and that we need someone to break in from outside, the whole of the Old Testament stands out against you. That's the point of verse 56. Your father Abraham, even your father Abraham, looked forward to my arrival. Your own sinful nature, all of Jesus' teaching, the whole of the Old Testament, God's authentication of Jesus stands out against you. That's the point of verse 56. Your father Abraham, that's not verse 56, I'm sorry, that's the point of verse 54. If I glorify myself, my glory means nothing. My father, who you claim as your God, is the one who glorifies me. And as well as our own sinful nature, as well as the teaching of Jesus, as well as the Old Testament, as well as God's authentication of Jesus, these religiously immaculate Jews stand against us. Because they are far more qualified than we will ever be. Their religious pedigree is immaculate. Their religious performance is impressive. Their response to Jesus is positive. But they think they can have a kind of DIY religion apart from Jesus. They refuse to admit that they need his help. And they end up picking up stones to stone God's Son. What do we conclude? Well, that Jesus Christ is authentically God's Son. He has broken in from outside, and he is the Son of God. He therefore has authority to speak about us and about our identity. And his assessment of our identity is that we are naturally slaves to sin, unable to help ourselves. And this group of religious Jews are unable to accept it, and they prove the point by picking up stones to stone him. Let's pray. I tell you the truth, everyone who sins is a slave to sin. A slave has no permanent place in the family. But the Son belongs to it forever, so if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed. Our gracious Father God, we acknowledge our standing before you as helpless, unable to help ourselves. We acknowledge that there is nothing in us that enables us to respond to you positively. We acknowledge that we need your help. And we praise you for your Son, Jesus Christ. We thank you for sending him. We praise you for his arrival announced by himself, anticipated by Abraham, and authenticated by you, our loving Father. We thank you for him. Amen.